astrology is not mere fortune telling. Is it in, you know, evidence in today in other areas as well?
Astrology and evidence is everywhere. In fact, it's probably one of the reasons why I personally got into this subject myself, is through studying ancient art. You know, medieval, Renaissance art. I think on a previous show we even talked about Botticelli's Venus, the famous painting of Botticelli's Venus.
Yeah.
You know, but it's not the only one. From Giotto, from the pre-Renaissance period, you see all the way down through into the neoclassical works of Nicolas Poussin. You know, I mean, basically the whole of art, the whole of pictorial art is absolutely loaded. You know, I'm thinking even of Albrecht Dürer, you know, the great German artist.
Yeah.
He left clues, astro-theological, astro-mythological clues throughout his art. We know that Nicolas Poussin did. We know that Leonardo da Vinci in the Middle Ages did. We have Giotto, we have Cimabue. So we've got a welter of information, you know, coming out of the Botticelli's, you see. All the way down through the great art, you keep seeing these astrological motifs, and you see these pagan motifs. The Bible. We were talking about the Bible. This new astrotheology book goes heavily into the astrotheology connections to the Bible. You know, that Jesus is the sun god, the sun king.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that his mother, Mary, you know, is clearly a representation of the constellation of Virgo. And near Virgo rises a constellation known as Butes. And Butes was always considered a male, you know, god or a male character.
Mm-hmm.
Because wherever you see Virgo rising, this Butes will also rise with Virgo. So that was Joseph in the Bible. Because wherever Mary was in the sky, Butes, you know, was nearby.
Followed, yeah.
So, yeah, it was the rising and setting of these constellations. Jesus was the sun because, of course, the sun in Egypt opened in the new year. The new year of the Egyptians opened in the sign of Virgo.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what the connection was between the young sun in the arms of the Virgin. The three wise men who visit, you know, Jesus Christ in the Nativity story, and people who've seen my DVD will know that, you know, I've covered all of this in the DVD. The three wise men, of course, were the stars of the constellation of Orion.
Yeah, yeah.
The three famous stars that are absolutely side by side in the sky. You know, the four animals around the cradle of Jesus happen to represent the four cardinal points. The very archangels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the very symbols that Christianity has assigned to them are astrological. They represent the cardinal points, etc.
Yeah, yeah.
The 40 days in their wilderness. You know, I've got a five-hour DVD, as you said, out there. We cover so many of these parts of Scripture, not just of Christianity, but of others as well. Going into how, and remember, Christianity is not just drawing on the stellar cult. You know, it's drawing on all the cults. It's a book full of information from the lunar cult, from the solar cult, from the Saturnian cult, from the volcano cult. We got all the cults' symbolism and traditions represented in the Bible. But that 40 days in their wilderness, you see, comes out of the idea that the sun spans about 30 degrees in each sign.
Right.
And when it passed through the sign of Cancer, because it doesn't have a lot of bright stars, was always referred to in the astrological canon as the wilderness, you see. So this is why you find this term, you know. And then, of course, the famous adversaries. Wherever there's a solar hero, you've got his enemy, be it Herod, you know, or be it the Philistines, you see, or be it Judas,
right?
You know, or whoever, you know. All the adversarial characters that turn up in the Bible also have their astrological counterparts. So it's all there in the Bible. But again, I find in my audience particularly, there's a lot of interest of how astrotheology turns up in the modern world, like in architecture. You know, the churches, the synagogues, the state flags, the emblems, the heraldry, even in the design of cities, is tremendously based on astrology. This is starting to come out now. City squares, civic buildings, not to mention clock towers, fountains, bridges, embankments. If your eyes are half open, you see. And you really go around with educated eyes, you're going to start seeing something that's going to leave you no doubt that these cults are anything but a relic of the past, you know.
That's right.
There's something interesting as well, you know, that each sign of the zodiac, and I mean the 12 famous signs, and also there are others. I talk about these other signs that should be known. I actually talk about them in the DVD also, and they turn up a lot in the corporate symbols, but let's leave that aside. Basically, each sign of the zodiac was also given to a portion of the earth. Did you know that? That each sign of the zodiac had a terrestrial counterpart. So England, Scotland, Wales, you know,
mm-hmm.
all of these locations on our planet Earth were actually assigned to different constellations of the zodiac. And even they went even further than that. Even certain boroughs, even certain towns, they'd subdivide it. For instance, London is divided into 28 boroughs.
Mm-hmm.
28 is the number of lunar mansions.
Huh.
It's based on lunar divisions, yeah.
Right.
So the whole of London is based on this. So you might even have a city or a state that is ruled over by more than one constellation or more than one sign.
Hmm.
Now, you won't know that, but you might be working around. You might be walking around in a borough of London. You might be walking around in Hayward, California. Or, you know, Palo Alto, right? Or wherever in America.
Mm.
Without the faintest idea that around you is stellar symbols, not only on the corporations, but in the city squares. You might be walking around Stanford. You might be walking around the Hoover Institute. You might be walking around San Francisco. Without the faintest idea that you're walking in a terrestrial map that is based on a celestial map.
Right.
But it's in concrete. Yeah, David Ovison found this out when he started researching the architecture of Washington, D.C.,
that
the entire Washington, D.C. is designed based on, you know, the movements of the planets of the star Sirius. And the whole architecture, as people now must know, I hope they know, is incredibly based on this old Masonic geometry. But you've got to go beyond that. It's not just Masonic. It's astrotheological.
That's right.
There's a reason why these people are based in the stars. Andrew Power, my friend in Ireland, discovered that when he started researching the Battle of the Boyne. To discover that there's not a single bullet or belt buckle to be found. This is a zone where there's meant to have been a war, for goodness sake. And not a single relic of war exists. The man found out that, hold on, the whole so-called Battle of the Boyne that's written up in so many histories of Ireland was a ritual battle based on the movement of Jupiter, movement of Saturn, movement of the Sun, moving in connection with the Milky Way. It was a ritual of handing over. One dragon bloodline, namely the Stuarts, were performing a ritual that involved hundreds of people down near Tara. It was actually very, very close to Newgrange. It was on the river because the river on Earth represents the Milky Way.
Mm-hmm.
The river on Earth also represents the Eridanus, which is a celestial river, a constellation up there near Taurus and Gemini. You see, so the king's horse going into the water. At the Washington Monument, don't you see the long strip of water in Washington, D.C.?
Indeed.
Yeah. Isn't the Houses of Parliament beside the River Thames?
Yeah.
Isn't Paris, the government beside the river? Isn't in Dublin the four courts on the river Liffey? What's going on here? And the river Liffey comes from the word Lifa, life, meaning, you know, the goddess of life. There's all pagan symbolism you got going there.
Right.
And the river is always running alongside because this is a heavenly river. So people are walking around in the delirium, not even aware of all of this astrotheology that is completely surrounding them. You know, these characters had a habit of breaking the zodiac down into 36 houses, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Those symbols are always around in our society. I see them in corporate products and even in the architecture. There was 72 other constellations in and around the astrological belt, Henrik. All of those have symbols that people don't know about. So you may be familiar with Leo the Lion, yeah, and you may know Aries, you know, because people wear a chain around their neck. They think they know about astrology. It's really fun. You know, okay, so you know the 12 signs. Do you know that there's 72 other signs that are used every day? By the corporate giants.
That's right.
Media outlets and on products. And you don't know that this is astrology right in front of your eyes. Think of Madison Avenue. You know, think of Columbia Pictures. The woman with the sun above her head and the moon under her feet. Every Catholic will understand what I've just said there. The woman who's radiant with the sun above her head and the moon under her feet and the crown of 12 stars. Everyone knows that's a symbol of Virgin Mary. What's that symbol doing on the Columbia Pictures then, I ask you, the logo?
Right.
Paramount, the mountain. Do you know that we're talking about the sun in Virgo when you're looking at that corporate logo?
Hmm.
Do you know a TriStar is the famous winged horse of Cancer and also Pegasus? Do you know MGM is the famous lion of Leo, you see? Or Orion, Disney, Touchstone. You know, let's go on. In the DVD, I've gone into this.
Yeah.
Astrotheology. You're asking where it is, Henrik? Where isn't it?
It's incredible. And what comes to mind is also, of course, from the famous prayer that as it is in heaven, so, you know, shall it be on earth, that this is about taking what is in heaven and bringing it down to earth, replicating it, then that this is and has been in the past, I guess, an important ritual on many levels, and one of course is being that this is a veneration, I guess, to the stars, that we're acknowledging that what we're seeing up there is something that we can, we're replicating it down here. So I mean, in a sense, that this to me also doesn't mean that this doesn't mean that it's evil. It doesn't mean that no. That these people are they're doing it because they want to use black magic on you. This is a It's connected with so much more, but we first of all have to become aware of it. That's the number one point, here.
Well, exactly. And remember, what does it say on the cover of the DVD in the book? Astrotheology. The word theology appears in the term.
Right.
Because it isn't black magic. It isn't evil. It's theology. But it's astrotheology. This is all, this is where we need to move the human race forward. This is your original theology. This was the original church. This was the original temple. This was the original chapel, cathedral, the temple of God. It all came from there. So, we're at the moment where we can start discovering the roots. So I've been saying it for as long as I can remember that by coming to the 21st and 21st and 22nd centuries, we are in fact coming full circle to something. But full circle to what? Circle to discovering where it all began,
So if we veer away a little bit from that area and talk a little bit about monotheism, making all of this, all the numbers of different things we have out there, if we talk about God or the stars or the planets or what have you, monotheism did not begin with Christianity. It officially began, as you pointed out many times on the show, of course, that it began with Akhenaten, and you've written extensively on this pharaoh and on his era in your book on Ireland. But what would have caused his avid worship of the sun? What caused him to abandon the egalitarian attitudes of the rest of the Egyptians?
That's a good point. And again, we can split hairs a little bit there. It didn't even really begin with Akhenaten, The monotheism was there a little bit before him. To be really strict about it, Thutmose III and very even possibly Amenhotep II, But Amenhotep II, I think, was such a lunatic. You can't really date anything from him. So people tend to think it was Thutmose III, is a more of a sure bet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you see that what we have to really remember is that all the way down until Akhenaten, officially everyone worshipped Amun-Ra. But that is like, saying to everybody in England, you officially accept that the queen is, the queen.
Right.
They're going to go, yes. But secretly they may think she's all right, whatever, right?
Right.
And they, think, well, hell yeah, but I don't believe in her or whatever, So this is what you have to understand. It was just politically correct. Because Amun was the god of Egypt. He was the, the tutelary god of Egypt. So everybody basically said, yes to Amun-Ra.
Mm-hmm.
Just like later on the Greeks, you couldn't say no to Jupiter. Otherwise, you'd find yourself in very hot water. But as long as you said yes to Jupiter, they basically didn't mind what else you did.
Right.
Jupiter's day, as long as you laid a few laurel leaves at Jupiter's thing. And by the way, this was the law. This was Roman law that all the Roman states, no matter where they were, even Cleopatra had to do it.
Hmm.
Just go and lay a few bloody leaves at Jupiter's, statue there, and the Romans couldn't care less what you do. It was somewhat the same way in Egypt. As long as you officially, and the pharaoh of course had to, the pharaoh was a representative of Amun, so on paper, absolutely on paper, Amun-Ra was the number one big cheese. But you see, personally speaking, in these families themselves, they had personal gods. And I would say that towards the Thutmoside dynasties leading up to Akhenaten, I believe that these Thutmoside 18th dynasty pharaohs, they personally couldn't care less about Amun-Ra or his priests.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what eventually led to the more worship of Aton. This is what it's all about. But to answer your question specifically, absolutely. Akhenaten was the man who basically turned up Egypt upside down. He openly and drastically changed the worship. He forbade the worship of other religions. He totally forbade the worship of Amun-Ra and all the other gods. He stopped funding the priests. He came up with Aton as the number one god,
Mm.
He moved the capital, all sorts of extremist things that he did. And he then began to exclude so much, because monotheism is nothing but exclusion. It's excluding other gods. It's not saying there is only one God. That's what Christians think, you know, you're saying.
Mm.
But no, Christians have to understand that monotheism is merely the exclusion of all other gods, but you're still accepting that those other gods exist.
Hmm.
Which is my point to Christians, is why don't you study it? Why don't you study these things? No, I'm not telling you to give up your Christianity or your monotheism, but why don't you just accept that there were other you know, religions that are very interesting and that, you know, may have a tremendous meaning for your own beliefs and your religion. Stop thinking of it all as evil.
Right.
But to get back to your question, you know, the reason why Akhenaten would have wanted to do this, what his real motive was, I believe, was insanity. Because the more that I've studied it, and of course, remember, I do have, you know, the work of Sigmund Freud in front of me and stuff like that, so maybe I am partial or whatever.
Right.
But I am one of the few authors, you see, who doesn't lionize Akhenaten.
You know, right.
Maybe I'm one of only two or three in the world who's written on this subject that simply does not fall into lockstep with everyone else thinking that he was just the greatest Christ before the Christ, the greatest light the world has ever known before Christianity. All of this nonsense. The man was a psychopath. You only have to read it. And by the way, this is corroborated by modern day reports from psychologists of people who would act in that way. People who would only worship the light, who don't recognize the darkness, who recognize shadow, who basically, you know, are pathologically afraid of that. That's well known to psychologists today to be a form of pathology in which the person is so divorced, you see, from their own unconscious mind, from their own inner drives and so on, that they basically live in a, you know, a super lit fluorescent, you know, I mean, Margaret Thatcher is a perfect example. The woman only slept, by her own admission, like 2 to 3, or, you know, 4 hours a night. She never slept ever more than 4 hours a night. And by the way, she always slept with the light on.
Really?
Yep. So that's just one example. Yeah. There's many other corporate jacks who operate in this way. You know, so it's a well-known thing. So we're dealing with a psychopath, but unfortunately he had a crown on his head, just like the psychopaths today have a crown on their head, or, you know, the ring of the fisherman on their, you know, little pinky or whatever.
Slippers.
We're still dealing with the same maniacs today.
Yeah.
And they've created a super lit, fluorescent, toxic, you know, world. Because they're all children of Akhenaten. They're all children of Aton, believe me, right down to the last one. Even the ones who don't know that they are, who don't think of any of this stuff. But unfortunately, this is what he did. And, you know, it ties into... Well, see, let's look at it this way. Akhenaten was so deranged, right, that even his own father, Amenhotep III, you know, didn't even want his... Akhenaten does not appear in any of the any of the wall drawings or etchings, you see?
Right.
With the royal family. His own father certainly did not want him to be around, and there's no doubt in my mind that his father did not want him to be the next pharaoh. The next pharaoh was going to be a brother of Akhenaten, but that guy died when he was very, very young.
Hmm.
And he died mysteriously, so we could have some intrigue there. We're not sure of that, because there's no evidence for any foul play, but the fact of the matter is that the younger brother, whose name was Thothmosis also, he died, and it left the way open for the Akhenaten to be made into the pharaoh. Reports also say that he had trouble speaking, just like the Bible talks about Moses having a speech impediment, so he had to have Aaron be his mouthpiece. Well, since we know now through the work of so many, you know, not so many, but from Ellis and Mustafa Gadala and from Ahmed Osman, that we now know that Moses and Akhenaten were the same man, just like so many people like Sigmund Freud had already tried to say this. Does that then imply that Akhenaten couldn't speak the language of the normal Egyptians, that he literally was not native himself, or that even if he was native, he spent so much time with foreigners within the borders of Egypt that even when he came to be the pharaoh, you know, he wasn't even clued in. He was they say he had a speech impediment. Could it not mean that he actually literally couldn't even speak in the dialogue or the language of the native Egyptians, you know? So we got a lot of questions about his loyalty and his patriotism to the country. But the bottom line is psychological. The man was a psychopath, and this worship of the sun needs to be approached from that point of view as well. If we can't see it in today's world, that this Luciferianism, this worship of the sun, is psychopathic, maybe we can see it when we look into the historical figures like Akhenaten to see that there's nothing natural about it. And did you know that in the last month, Henrik, new discoveries, new digs, there's been excavations at Amarna. This is the great city of the sun that Akhenaten built.
Right.
Which has always been put forward. And I really want to emphasize this, because this place, this Amarna, has been put in books from the 1800s onwards as the great capital of light, you know, the great holy city that Akhenaten built. Now they dug the place up physically, and they're finding corpses, they're finding poverty, they're finding people who died in agony, they're finding huddled bodies and all sorts of, you know, debris. And they're finding out the place was a freaking toilet, man. They were it's a grim, fear-written hellhole. Yeah. I didn't make this up. I've got, you know, shoot. It's on the blog. It's on my forum. Right. They found the evidence. They found the evidence. But before, they're going to tell you, so suddenly it turns out to be Stephen Kingville, but before, it was the heavenliest place on earth. I better stop talking about the subject.
Very interesting. So this is very recent findings, you say?
Within the last couple of weeks, believe really? It's fresh off. They've been digging the place up, and I bet you they've been hoping that they're going to find, you know, all the evidence to show what a great darling of God this Akhenaten was.
Right.
Well, to their shock, amazement, horror, they're clamming over bodies that look awful. That there's completely evidence that shows that the place was, you know, horrible, and it was people were in agony. They were unhappy. They were not feeling at home. They, you know, all the evidence has been discovered. Big shock, you know. Well, listen. Psychopath opens his playpen. What do you think is going to happen? You know, Norman Bates opens a motel. You want to go and stay there? Oh, go ahead.
Right,
don't
right.
come up dead in the morning.
Yeah. That's a good point. And of course, you mentioned an important word there, Lucifer or Luciferian. You know, in your work, you talk about this. You know, a disciple of light is a Luciferian. And Akhenaten was a chief Luciferian, then maybe we can say his Atonism was Luciferian, and therefore Christianity, or the outgrowth of Akhenaten's monotheism, should really be thought of as Atonism and therefore Luciferian, right?
You bet. And if only the world would get that, you know, because when it's fully understood, when what you've just said there is fully understood deeply and reverently, with understanding, not just prejudicial knee-jerk reaction, but intellectually understood, what is light? What is Luciferianism? And we've got information. We've got information on that. You know, we'll put the links up, hopefully, on our this Red Eyes page.
Right.
Of this interview. And people are welcome to go and make a detailed study of the links we'll put up that have links to the real meaning of Lucifer. We've even done a previous show, you and I, on Lucifer, you know, where...
Indeed.
We examine some of the different words, where, you know, roots or origins or whatever of that. And see, maybe, old Akhenaten, you know, can't totally be blamed. Maybe his clan of sun worshippers can't be blamed, because after all, what are we talking about? We're talking about 1400 years BC. Well, what was going on 10,000 years before that?
Catastrophe.
Worldwide global catastrophe.
Right. Yeah.
Possibly even 50,000 years ago. But, you know, we can't be sure when we look far back. But we know that sometime back in history, between 13,500 BC and about 50,000 years BC, there was catastrophes of such enormity. And one of those catastrophes was what? I've talked about it in my first book on Atlantis, the destruction of the second sun.
Yeah.
I must say that wasn't a sun. It was a large planet known as, and by the way, one of the names of it was Lucifer. Another name was Tiamat. Another name was Marduk. Yeah. Another name was Rahab. You know, but this great 12th planet in our solar system was destroyed. People always thought it was a sun. When that sun, think of the psychology, when you see the sun destroyed, isn't the one sun that now is called Sol, because Sol means solitary, he's the alone one in the sky.
Yeah.
Aren't you going to be, if you think the sun is a god, you didn't think he was a god, you knew that he wasn't a god, they worshiped the deity through the sun. Nobody in the pagan times believed the stars were gods, that needs to be totally cleared up. But just for argument's sake here, obviously, the sun is the bringer of life. One sun is already gone. What's to stop the other one from blowing up? And what happens when light does disappear? What do you have?
Darkness.
Right. So if a person then becomes pathologically, or if a people become pathologically afraid of darkness, it could be for a very physiological reason. If the physical sun has left you and been destroyed, and you are now surrounded by darkness, your psychology will in fact change. And your prayers to the one sun that's left, hey, buddy, don't go out, please don't leave us,
right,
is going to literally become a religion, a theology, won't it? Because it's born out of trauma.
Mm-hmm.
I've basically said in my work that almost everything that man does is born out of trauma.
Yeah.
Well, here we have now a perfect, focal. We focused in on one particular area, that maybe these religions and these potentates did have a bugbear about this because they were so afraid of darkness. They literally were afraid that the light of the day, the light of the morning would go out. And so that every time it arose on the eastern horizon was a day for jumping out of bed and just going out there and celebrating, you know, and praying to the sun and bowing down and all the rest of it.
Well, I mean, I just want to interject, we can even squeeze in here the if we look at some of the South American cultures like the Maya, Aztec, so forth, again, possibly that might be a reason for some of the sacrifice that went on there, you know, in veneration of the sun. You know, we this one shouldn't, you know, die. The last one we have left, we need to sacrifice people, you know, day after day, continuous the stream, you know, who knows?
Wouldn't people be already sacrificed if the sun didn't rise?
Of course, they would die.
Everything would die within a very short period of time. And these ancients knew that. And since one sun had already, it literally exploded in the sky. And all sorts of trauma had come out of that. It doesn't really, you know, I don't find it far-fetched at all to think that the adoration of the sun would replace a more balanced, egalitarian worship of other planets, other stars, you know, the normal astrotheologies of the normal priest cults that used to exist, where every body, every orb, every body in the sky was, you know, given incredible kudos and incredible attention to detail.
Right.
But if some great tragedy had taken place, eventually the sun cults would have said, listen, the sun is more important. The sun is more important. And from that point, you see, things may have developed. I mean, again, I'm speculating, but when we're looking into the origins of the psychopathy now, we do have to look back to the fact of these catastrophes and that maybe there was a sort of a warped method in the apparent madness, you know, solar fixation, what is called the solar fixation. And psychologists know, don't they, that in order to prevent yourself becoming sick, you make yourself sicker psychologically. That's what repression is. That's what a lot of these psychological problems arise from, is not trying to continually do things that make you sick. Most psychological problems come out of trying to make yourself well.
Right.
But in a wrong way.
Interesting.
So again, Akhenaten may have thought he was onto something here.
Yeah.
And had no time for all this other malarkey, you know, with Osiris and vegetable cults and underworld cults and stuff like that. He was thinking, you know, the sun is what it's all about. And, you know, that's a very, very powerful, you know, you can turn that into some real powerful theology if you know how to do it right. But coming back to your main point, absolutely, Luciferianism, what Christians know as Luciferianism, they have to realize that their own religion has been created by Luciferianism, Luciferians. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's definitely worth thinking about that one, because again, it's we you know, just read. I was reading this pamphlet from a local church around here, and again, it was all about. And this was, I think, around springtime, and it was all about the light. They of course refer to it as the Christ light or the light of Christ, but again, it's the same. It's the illumination, the Illuminati, the Luciferianism, and again, that doesn't mean. Just because we say Luciferianism, that doesn't again connotate that this is is an evil thing. But it says what the word means. It's about light. Right. You know, it's about
the theology of light. Yeah. It's a specific kind of worship. There's no difference between that word and Christianity. There's no difference in that word than Atenism. In fact, there's even probably more accuracy in the word Luciferianism than there is Christianity and there is in Atenism. The word Luciferian is probably even a better word to use, talking about it etymologically for sure, because that's what the Bible is full. And I have lists and lists and lists in the book of biblical passages, you know, just like the one you quoted, that are talking about that God is light, God is light, God is light. It's all about light. Well, why don't people think about that for a moment and get into it and analyze and discover what this whole concept means, you know, and then look around the world today and see how many symbols of the sun and how many other, you know, solar symbols you see.
Yeah.
Like the eye, you know, the eye of Ra, whatever, are all around in our world today. There's something going on.
Definitely is. Okay, so that's the, you know, we know that the solar cults obviously is there. Their mark is, you know, very clear throughout society. Were there other cults, you know, before this one, the main one, popped up?
Yeah, there was. Yes, the solar cult is basically an outgrowth of several other cults, the most important one being the stellar cult. And the book I'm writing, the astrotheology book, is chiefly about the stellar cult and what they believed, what they were into, you know, and what they taught, you know, both in Ireland and in Amanist Egypt. But there was also the lunar cult, This is a very, very, very important cult for one important reason, and that's the Old Testament. The Old Testament Jehovah can be traced back to the main god of the lunar cult. This can be done. You know, but the lunar cult, the letter of our alphabet, the letter C and the letter U represent the moon. That's because they're shaped like the crescent moon, you see.
Of course.
The number 14, the number 28, certain numbers that we saw. The number 7, for instance, the famous number 7 is partly a lunar number. We find lunar crescents on all the Islamic flags, don't we?
Yeah.
You know, what's that all about? They're meant to be a solar cult worshipping a solar god, but their old flags have crescent moons on them and stars on them. That's, again, the point, that these old cults predate the new cults, you see.
Mm-hmm.
But right down to music, you know, the musical keys, which were based on the movement of the planets, the alphabetical letters and vowels, especially the sacred vowels, were all dedicated to certain planets by these cults. Architecture reveals it. You know, the shape of the mosque, the design of certain temples, people's daily rituals, the calendrical ceremonies of the calendar.
Mm, yeah.
All of this stuff. I mean, even right down to games that we play, you know, like snakes and ladders and hopscotch and all of these things. They all go back to this, you know.
Mm.
The titles that the clergy use, you know, minister, monk, magistrate, all of these very famous, deacon.
Yeah.
All of these terms come from these various cults, not one cult, but from many. But the sad thing is, you see, that the stellar cult was the great cult that had lasted for thousands of years, and all these other cults are basically colleges within the larger college. Just like in a school, you can have fraternities.
Right.
Or in schools in England, you have what's called houses in a school.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's exactly what this was. All the other cults were subdivided cults of the greater stellar cult. They are all borrowed and cannibalized the symbols of the stellar cult. And it's the stellar cult that really interests me more than anything else, because that's where so many of our traditions come from. But the sad thing is that the true teachings of the stellar cult were already lost long before even the time of Plato. Can you imagine? So when we're looking to Plato's time and even Pythagoras' time, you know, people look to these guys as if there's something so special, so holy. It's like, hang on, you know, some of the bunk that these people believed. I mean, isn't it Plato? No, I'm serious. Plato and Pythagoras fall into the old stellar cult, fall into the old solar cult concept that the earth and matter is negative and spirit is up there somewhere and it's positive.
Uh-huh.
They're already dealing with a dualism in their philosophy, which already shows you they're miles away from understanding, you see, the true tenets of theology. During the time of Plato, they already believed that, you know, my God, that the earth was what? A cylinder. Yeah, did you know that? They actually believed that the earth was cylindrical shaped, or maybe, you know, a flat.
Really?
Yeah, they thought Echo was a devil shouting back at you. Come on, Henry.
That's interesting.
They believed that headless men in Africa were walking around with an eye in their chest.
Okay.
At the time of Herodotus. The great historian Herodotus, the great Greeks, the fantastic, the Romans, yeah. These are the guys who are telling you that there's headless men in Africa. All men in Africa are headless with an eye in the middle of their chest, for goodness sake. That echoes, yeah, and the demons can cause, you know, pregnancy to a woman. Watch out.
Oh, well, okay,
so,
yeah.
We're already, it's not that, oh my goodness, you know, the stellar cult. Their teachings were already contaminated and perverted and defaced by the time we've even got to the Greeks. Mm. And it's from the Greek time that we're looking back where we have this imaginary, fallacious, erroneous idea that, oh, those silly pagans believed that the sun and the stars were gods. They knew they were not. They knew that God is something else. And in fact, this is what I talk about heavily in the new book, is also about the true theology. What was the teachings of the Arya, the teachings of the Magi? What was all this about? What was it all about? What was all of the looking at the stars and all the mathematical computations, you know? What was it all about? Was it about men who were divorced from themselves, or was it about man studying himself? What is the difference between those cults of the yesteryear who knew that there was no division between matter and consciousness, and that nature was certainly not lower, but was also spiritual? Because if you believe, as the ancient stellar cult and the ancient druids did believe, that spirit is everywhere, there's no such thing as a material world trapping any soul or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that different than the Christianity we have today? Because if everything is spirit, then how can matter be trapped in spirit? I mean, in other words, if there is no such thing as matter, and everything is a version of spirit, how can spirit trap spirit? You see, it becomes a paradox.
Yeah.
So you have people who are not looking to that. You don't have people who believe in a hell. And you don't have people who believe in a malignancy of matter.
Right.
And we, in our age, is going to have to get back to that understanding very, very quickly if there's meant to be any kind of survival.
Hmm.
Because we have people, all the things that, for instance, let me be brutal about it, everything that Monsanto and all of these corrupt corporations are doing today has a philosophy behind it. The philosophy that nature is just something foreign, and lower and manipulatable and reduplicatable and,
improvable.
Provable, exactly, and it has nothing to do with you. Your body is certainly not part of nature, and your mind is not part of nature. And ergo, all of these people who are deluded in the same psychopathic way are now ready to bring the world to the brink of annihilation and man to the brink of insanity. It's happening right as we speak, and its roots are ancient. Its roots go back all the way.
But there were plenty
of other cults before the Solar Cult.
Hmm.
And the Bible is their manifesto. Their Bible is literally the. As garbled as it is the testament of all of these different cults of the ancient world.
Right. It's a mishmash in a way. It's put everything together in one. And again, it's that idea of it's mono, it's one, it's uno. It's bringing all of the previous things into one worshipful religion. It's the same reflection that, this is supposed to be one, mono.
And don't we have that? Haven't we got that mantra today in the world of the corporations, in the terms of politics and global government, oneness?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
First they're talking about diversity with one breath, but we already know they're talking about global and oneness and unification. These are old terms. These are not something that's just dreamt up in the last 30 years.
That's right. That's a very good point. Globalization. And even, again, if we return to the idea of the New Age movement and criticize that a little bit, that's the same thing there, that it, all is one. I mean, in a sense, what we have been talking about is that is true, because what you just referred to was that spiritually, if everything is spirit, so obviously it all is one. But at the same time, it's on the same route or same path of the monotheistic, idea that everything is one and should be one, and there's no difference. And I don't, I personally don't agree with that. I think there's diversity in the world,
Exactly. And let's be very specific about it, so, the listeners really grasp this paradox, or let's put it better, they can untwist the paradox. You untwist the paradox of this oneness lie by realizing what I've said on previous shows about, just because you want to edit reality doesn't mean that there is, in fact, a one-season world. The oneness that these people are talking about, these globalists, is a oneness of exclusion. Remember we talked about Akhenaten being an excluder, or monotheism being an excluder?
Right.
So what we're dealing with here is a painstaking process of exclusion in order to make this oneness. It's not a true oneness, it's a manufactured oneness. The spiritual oneness of what you're talking about is utterly, completely different. If we want to explore that just in a couple of sentences, the spiritual oneness is only available or only perceivable to a person who is an individual, meaning one.
Right.
But it's a oneness that is not the oneness that is, hey, I've taken all these pieces and I've clumped them all together. Look at my papier-mâché monster here.
Right,
it's one.
Right.
it's Quatermass, and we got all the little entities all massing up and gluing themselves together into one hideous monster. There's your oneness.
Yeah, indeed. I mean,
that is oneness, but that's the Frankensteinian horror story of the Night of the Zombies, where everybody is one clump, one consciousness, one big amorphous nothing, but in one place or in one sphere collected. All the emptiness, all the criminality, all the toxicity, all the stupidity, all the sensuality, all the narcissism, all nicely packaged and, delivered on a plate to you, by the world system, and presented with a nice big package of oneness that is anything but the oneness of the other spiritual kind. So we're in a one-season world of edited reality. And because, as Sigmund Freud and everybody pointed out, reality itself is one of the most painful things for this human mind, you see, as a child. Remember we talked about how infantile people are emotionally and psychologically? I said they may be developed technologically and intellectually, but they're arrested emotionally. Well, now we can add to that more sense. We can clarify what I meant by that, is that, you see, the infantile person can't be an individual. He can't perceive reality directly. Reality is incredibly frightening to that fragile, you know, mind, type of mind. Mm-hmm. So you have to manufacture a kind of reality. You literally create what's called a simulacra.
Right.
And you create a sampled, just like a machine can sample music.
Right.
That you can't even tell the difference if it's a real violin or a real harp or a real oboe. You know, people in musicals who do musical sampling know this.
Right.
And the idea is to get it as perfect as possible. And you can now get the sample so perfect that a whole orchestra could be playing and you wouldn't even know it's some guy on a keyboard doing it.
Indeed.
So this is exactly what the mind, the ego, is all about. The ego, the empresario, and the people we have in power are sampling reality. And within that sampled, wholly artificial reality, they start clipping. Because in order to create that sample, you still need some sort of channel or pipeline to the real. Right. You don't want to, but you have to because you're sampling. You have to have your little MIDI digital connector. As the little tabernacle, you know, your little idea of reality, the little sphere of the simulacra becomes absolutely wall-to-wall perfect. I mean, you've got all the furniture in there. It's all, you know, you've read all the Japanese manuals and everything is in perfect position. Everything's working. And all the remote controls, all 30 of them are lying on the table. Everything's under control. You can turn the lights on. You can dim them. You can open the fridge door. You can say lights go on and they go on. Once you have that entire salient green world working for you there, you now, you see, don't need those ties to the real world.
Right.
And Henrik, we're living in the 21st century, and the countdown to 2012, where the snippers are out. The actual cable cutters are now clipping one by one all the connectors to the real world.
Yeah.
And you're going to live in the sanitized, you know, completely anesthetized, artificial little salient green reality. But it's got a big, big sign over the door to make you happy. Oneness. Smile, obey.
Right.
You're under control. Be okay, you know? So this is the thing that I'm talking about. Now, in that realm, you have the oneness. But the real oneness is a totally remote, different thing that first you have to be an individual to be able to understand.
The oneness that I feel is the, you know, is what we are a part of every day. It's I mean, the universe in itself, it's a oneness. What we are being part of on this planet, all the thing that's happening. We are already one. We don't need to go into a fake oneness or a simulation of that oneness, but that is what is happening right now. And I mean, again, if we follow the trend and look at some of the technological advancements to connect this idea again here, just the other day, you know, Matrix style worlds are just, you know, a few years away. I mean, they're getting there. They're so close now, you know.
See, like I said, it comes back to exclusion. To live in the real world, exclusion doesn't work. You have to be holistic. You have to understand the holarchy. You have to see the ugliness in the beauty and the beauty in the ugliness. You see, it's a different kind of thinking. It's a different kind of organic process that relates to the real world.
Right.
The mind can choose not to be real. It can choose to get into all sorts of analog states. And therefore, you don't need that in the analog world. You see, in this simulacra, you don't require all of this real interaction with reality because reality has basically traumatized you. So in the real world, there's less chance for exclusion. There's more likelihood. Reality pulls you to be, you know, more understanding in a true and organic way. Whereas the other world doesn't ask you to do anything like that. It asks you to conform and to routine and to have rhythms and to have reduplicatable realities, you know. This is
right.
The difference.
Right, right. Michael, so let's go backtrack a little bit again and go over a few more points that we want to bring up here. Most of the major solar cults' gods were transplanted from the West, from Ireland, as you've been writing about. Is this what you believe, Michael?
Yeah, this is, I think the theme of a lot of my work in the Irish Origins concept is that even the gods, the pantheons themselves, not just the astrology, and again, I emphasize, you see, that it's much easier to see the stars of the northern hemisphere from northern climes, after all. And many of even the etymological terms for the star signs, particularly the word Arcadia. You see, the Arcadians actually refer to the Phoenicians, and the Phoenicians can be tracked to Scotland and to Ireland. So, and they were the great navigators, the great astronomers. So I actually believe that astronomy, astrology as a science / navigation, is a Northwestern invention.
Right.
And I believe that time will hold me out. And then, of course, when you start to want to tell the story of the zodiac, that becomes difficult to people who are not familiar. So you create what's called astromythology. You create the characters of the gods, you know, that later become the gods and the heroes. But that's a story, and the ancient people always knew it was a story. They didn't believe that, you know, the constellation of Orion was really a god, you know, called Osiris. It wasn't like that at all. But yeah, the movement was from the west to the east. There's many indications of this being the case, you know. For instance, I'll give you another example, the word church. Christians go to church. Where does that word come from? You know, the word church actually comes from the word meaning circle. The Greek circe and the Scottish Gaelic kirk meant a circle, circe, a circle. But the circle, just like we said, it's not just about a crocodile in the Nile. Well, in this analogy, it's not just about a circle, any circle, all circles. It's a specific kind of circle that was the church, the circle of the circumpolar region of the sky. Up there in the northern part of the sky where the pole is, where the pole basically faces. Of course, the pole is leaning, isn't it? 23 degrees, but it still points up to the sky nevertheless.
Right.
So that part that the pole points to was always considered the heaven of heavens, the holy of holies. And that circle, it's not very big, but it contains some very important stars like Ursa Minor and the famous pole stars, of course. That was, believe me, that was the original church. That's where the word comes from. The word church is a corruption of the goddess who ruled that celestial garden of the north. That little circle was always considered a celestial garden, a celestial enclosure. It was known as the Garden of Aru. It was known as many names. In Scandinavia, it's called Asgard. Asgard. You see, it's Camelot, you know. It's all sorts of names have been given to it down through time. But the ruling deity of the garden was called Ta'urt. It's where the word tarot comes from. But the word Ta'urt, the T's were softened to C-H. So the Ta'urt became Charuch or Charut, which is the word, the origin of the word church. So again, the very church that Christians go to is based on the stars. You had even Ralph Ellis on not too long ago, and he was giving a fascinating interview with you about his take on the meaning of the word Camelot. Remember that?
Right, yeah.
You pointed out that the ancient name of Egypt was Cam, you see, and in the Arthurian tradition you have this famous Camelot. But see, Camelot didn't just Cam, and first of all, Cam did not all mean Egypt. Cam meant the black land.
Right.
The land of the mysteries, the land of the sacred teachings. Okay? And the sacred teachings, as I'm saying, was astrology. So their Cam is the Hermetic sciences, which involves astrology. The land of astrology, the land of the tree and the serpent. Now, when we find it in the Arthurian tradition, Camelot, it referred to the Cam up there. Cam is a word that means to revolve, like cam shaft in a car.
Right.
So yeah, the word Camelot represented the round table up there in the sky, you know. Caer Sidhe was what the ancient Gaelic used to call it, the revolving castle, the round table, the zodiac. So all of this, without the astrotheology, you see, you're bound to think of it in terms of physical realities, physical people, physical events, and it's fine to study that and all the rest of it, but too many scholars are constantly leaving out the astrotheological aspect, and they're heading for trouble when they do that. You know, all the Arthurian pantheon, just like the dramatis personae of the Bible, just like the famous 12 tribes of Israel, all of it can be related to the heavens. All of it took their names from constellational phenomena, from data from the heavens, you see. You know, for instance, the Moganli Fay. Well, Moganli Fay is borrowed from the old. In fact, all the pantheon of, do you know, the whole pantheon of the Arthurian legend is basically a rescripting of the older Gaelic pantheon from Ireland.
Really?
Oh yeah. Excalibur, for instance, the sword Excalibur that King Arthur wields is nothing more than a total rescripting of the sword of the great High King Nada, and that sword was called Retaliator. It's a prototype of Excalibur. Excalibur is not original. It comes from Irish mythology, that the great sword of power that will vibrate when evil comes near it, you see, and is a sign of great royalty. And if the king doesn't have his sword, you know, he's in trouble and all that.
Right.
So we have like Morganley Fay. This is the sister of King Arthur in the Arthurian legend. She is based on a goddess of the Irish tradition. This is thousands of years before Arthurian legend was scripted. Is known as the Morrigu or the Morrigan, a great queen, wizard of Ireland. We have Sir Lancelot, the famous Sir Lancelot, being based on the Sun King of Ireland, Lugh, who was the great warrior hero, you see, the one who prepared everyone for battle and the one who defeated evil and was the Sun King.
Right.
So, you know, the list goes on. The whole Arthurian legend is not an Eastern concoction. It is absolutely a rescripting. It has a, of course, it has a I'm not denying that it hasn't been used by Christians of later ages.
Sure, sure.
We've already established in this very show that the Christians cannibalized older traditions. But the fact of the matter is some of the older traditions go back to the Zodiac and they go back to the old stellar cults of Ireland and the West. This is important. I'll give you one more example just. The word Druidism was divided into three categories. And the third category was a group known as the Ovates. O-V-A-T-E, Ovate. But that comes from a Gaelic word, fed, right? The fade is translated in our word today as faith.
Right, right.
Faith, the English word faith, having faith, or Adam faith, right, comes from the old Gaelic fed, which meant a druid. The word fate, like your destiny, your fate, the fates are with me, right?
Yeah.
Is exactly from the same Gaelic word root. And the word Vatican, because the F and V have always been interchangeable, so Vate, Fate, Vat, Vatican is also the place of the fates, or the men of faith. It has many meanings, because can also means the serpent. Yeah. But the word Vatican can be translated as the place of the men of faith. But the original men of faith were the Ovates, was the Druidical order.
The
men of faith.
Interesting.
And the job of the Ovate, what the Ovates actually did within Druidism was that they were judges. There were many things, but they were also judges. The word judge, Judah, comes from the same root as the word Judah, the tribe of Judah, or Jews.
Right, right.
Meaning that the Jews and the so-called tribe of Judah were nothing more than Ovates. They were the judges. They were the Levitical judges, you see. The words all come back to the same origin. So again, I'm doing this because we have to emphasize the fact that etymology, symbolism, this cuts through all of the nonsense, you know. And if I may even give one more example.
Please go ahead.
If there's time, it's a short one. The word Kohen, all Jewish people refer to the Kohen as the priest. That's what in Hebrew, Kohen, C-O-H-E-N, means, is high priest or prince. And originally it even represented a serpent prince because they were Levites, they were people of the tribe of Dan, and the symbol of the tribe of Dan was a serpent. Where does that word Kohen come from? Because we also have Khan. We have Can in France, the town Can.
Right.
We have Cahen, right? We have Calvin, because John Calvin changed his name. His name was John Kohen. The founder of Protestantism was Jewish, and he was called John Kohen. And he changed his name to Calvin. But the origin of that word, Henrik, is Irish. Con, C-O-N, is the root from which all those words come. And Con in Irish meant the priest. Isn't it strange that today when we use the word con, C-O-N, it means a fraud?
Right, right.
Look at the way, again, words have a mysterious way of telling you the truth about something. It is a con. These priests are nothing but a con. Even the Kohens and the cons, it turns out in the end to mean the greatest con on earth.
Conspiracy, you know.
Conspiracy. Priest-spiracy.
Right.
Never ending, you know. It's fascinating, this
interesting
stuff with the words.
Yeah.
But make no mistake about it, there was a flow from the West to the East of these traditions. It wasn't that somebody in the East came and brought enlightenment or astrotheology or any kind of theology to Britain. Quite the reverse.
Michael, we have about 7 minutes left, before we need to round things up, but the sky dance or Scythians, is that something that you would like to touch upon at all in this program here?
Yeah, this is again a key area that I've gone into. The study of secret society symbolism led me to it. It tells us something is not correct about most of the theories concerning the origins of, religion and Freemasonry, Templarism, and so on, again, symbolism. You see, one of the things that we notice in secret society organizations is the use of the double cross.
Indeed.
Not just one cross, but two. I've always wondered why that was. I've always wondered why the symbol of the Knights Templar is the two knights riding a single horse.
Yeah, yeah.
Often that horse is shown facing the left or the western side. The horse's head is facing west.
Uh-huh.
And this really fascinated me because it goes into the whole story of the connection between the Scythians, which is Northern Europeans, and the Hyksos dynasty of Egypt. This was a very big theme in the Irish Origins book.
Yeah.
And basically all I want to say about it is that we don't even know, first of all, if the word Scythian is a truly a word that was used in the by these people. The earliest word that we can find for them is Saka, S-A-C-A or S-A-K-A. Mm-hmm. And it's the origin of the word Saxon.
Interesting.
Because the Scythians, in fact, the Scythians were, in fact, the ancestors of many different groups. They're the ancestors of a group, a very interesting group called the Sarmatians that have just come to light.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, who are married to the Amazon women. Anyone who's into Amazons, the famous warrior females, you see, there's a connection here.
Right, right.
But they all go back to Scythian. The language they spoke was a form of Scythian, you see. So who are these amazing Scythians? And to me, my book explores the Scythian-Hyksos connection, you know, and we'll put up plenty of links on this Red Eyes page.
Right.
I hope people will look into, because it's a fascinating, fascinating thing, you know. But Saka did not mean, like people are telling us, blade men or spear men. They, mm-hmm. they always tell you lies about what these words mean. Some words are particularly corrupted. They make sure you never find out the word, like the meaning of the word Gothic.
Right.
The meaning of the word Scythian. They definitely, and the word Celtic. These are some words that for centuries the conspiracy is that, you know, you're not going to find out the true meaning of these words. But the word Saka actually meant stag men.
Horsemen.
And the stag, yeah. The stag was the famous Hearn, the famous forest god of Egypt that was also venerated, believe it or not, in Egypt. There's even a goddess of the hind, very much like Diana, the goddess, the Greek goddess Diana, who's always shown with a hind.
Uh-huh.
Isis was always shown with a hind. There was other goddesses also shown with the stag god, the hind goddess, you see. So the Scythians then were the stag men. And okay. Saka also gives rise to the name Isaac. Isaac. Isaac is actually wrongly pronounced. It should be pronounced Isaac, right? The Saka, Isa of the Saka, right? It's the Saka.
Right.
Like Saxon. Anglo-Saxon is a corruption of the word Saka. The Scythians, the people of the great knowledge, the people of the, you know, in fact, talk about one word. Earlier when we were talking, you know, the whole idea of one language, one Tower of Babel, one universal language.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
This ties into the Scythians because they were the great masters of knowledge and the great masters of language. They had a worldwide college. And these Scythians and Isaac was who? Isaac was the son of Abraham who came from Egypt from where? The northwest. He came into Egypt from the north. And the Bible will always tell you that he came from, you know, Mesopotamia, from Babylon, from Ur.
Yeah.
But could it be that he actually was a Scythian and came from further north, from even into Europe, him and his son? Yeah. The word Isaac seems to indicate so.
Very interesting. What
happens then if it turns out that the founders of Egypt, even before the time I usually talk about, even in the later times of the time of the Hyksos, turn out to be also connected to northwestern tribes?
Well, I mean, it's possible. At this point, at least, we don't have any clear connection, I guess. Or connection we have, but we don't have the, you know, clear evidence for it. But a lot of things, you know, it could very well be that way, you know? We don't know.
Again, people have to, you know, look into the etymology. This is the meaning of words, you know, to look into the origins of these. I think it really does give a lot of evidence when you look at that. I mean, my book goes into the story of the Chaldeans, the story of the Amorites. You know, let's look at another word. I mean, for instance, you know, the Babylon was there was a great city called Eridu,
right,
on the Tigris and Euphrates River. Eridu, Eri, because Eridu is spelled E-R-I-D-U. Eri is one of the oldest known Irish goddesses. It's where we get the word Hera, like the, you know, the Greek goddess Hera. It's also where we get the word terra, like terra firma, terrestrial.
Right.
It comes from a goddess's name, the ancient name of Tara in Ireland, Terry. Well, we have in Babylon, Eridu, the very name of the goddess of Ireland, is one of the cities of Egypt, cities of Babylon.
Right.
We can go further. We have a term called Eric, E-R-E-C-H, was the whole region of Mesopotamia that later became known in the Bible as Shinar, the plains of Shinar, which represented the whole of Mesopotamia. No, Shinar is only a biblical meaning of that name. The original name was Eric, E-R-E-C-H. Now, tell me, go and tell, ask a Scandinavian person that they don't recognize that word, Eric.
It's a name. Yeah, of course.
It's one of the most oldest and famous names.
Right.
Very distinctive. It's very distinct. Etymology is very distinctive. You find this, and then you go to the Babylonians, and they're telling you that Marduk, the worship of the god Marduk, who is more best known as Merodach, that's nothing but the Irish Murdoch,
yep.
is coming from the northwest.
Yeah.
The Babylonians in their own writings tell you that their civilization was started by Northwesterners, you see. We get the word erected, like when you erect a monument. Eric.
Right, right, of course.
Ur. Abraham's home city, Ur. Isaac's home city, Ur. No, it's not Ur, it's Ar. Aria, from the R. A-R. See, words, vowels have been twisted so that we don't see this. There's so many words. Did you know Sumeria is Sum-Aria?
Sum-Aria.
The land of the Aria.
Hmm.
And the word in Gaelic, Scots Gaelic, Sumer, means serpent.
Really?
Like I said, yeah. And Murdoch, I just said Marduk is a very poor translation of Merodach.
Yeah.
Merodach. Where have we heard the Mer, M-E-R, is the biggest giveaway. I've written chapters on just that word root alone.
Yeah.
M-E-R, representing not only the builders of the pyramid, who we've established as Aria, but Mer is men of the sea. You were talking about them earlier.
Yeah, yeah, indeed.
This is a word root that turns up in Mercury, turns up in merchant. Who are the mercurial ones? Who are the merchants? The Mer. And then we can track them. Amorites. Right?
Right.
Exactly, in the Babylonians, one of the oldest civilizations is called Amorite, coming from the word Mer. M-E-R.
Right.
And then those people can be tracked all the way down into France and Spain as the Merovingian dynasty.
That's right, yeah. Big.
You know, we've got a tremendous chain of etymology here. And in fact, the Mer were nothing more than the Phoenicians. These very sea people that you mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
But here's the key with that. The Phoenician is also not really their own name. They didn't call themselves that.
Right.
The Phoenicians referred to, and all the ancient original historians referred to the Phoenicians as the word Kabiri.
Hmm.
But even the word Kabiri is a corruption. It should be Kab-Ari.
Right, okay. Hmm.
Not Kabiri, but Kabari. The Kab-Ari. There's your Ari again, the Aria.
Yeah.
We find this word Kabari, you know, this or the Aria. And here's the interesting thing. They were the builders of the Temple of Solomon. They worked in trees. They were the men who worked with the wood better than anyone else in the entire world.
Mm-hmm.
Where does the word Kabbalah come from? Kab-Ari, Kabbalah?
Hmm.
Could the Kabbalistic system be of the Kabari? I think so. And it's a tree of life, isn't it? Well, the Kabari were the great tree men. They were the great builders of the temples of Solomon who knew wood better than anyone else. Their physical temples were a Kabbalistic temple. The Kabbalah is nothing but a theoretical temple, isn't it? A secret tradition.
Right.
Right. So who builds the temple? People are thinking about a physical temple in stone. No. Who builds the temple? Who are the temple men? Who are the priests of the great temple of the Kabbalah, of the knowledge? These are the Kabari, you see.
Hmm.
And Egypt was even known as the land of the tree and the serpent.
That's right. Yeah, of course.
Years before Christianity ever took birth. That's related to astrotheology, but it also relates to the Mer, to these Phoenicians, their high teachings.
Hmm.
So we have division, and it's people.
Yeah.
Ahead.
Oh no, I just want to say again, we have all of these different names, and that has later been put upon potentially the same people. We have, you know, over here we have the Phoenicians, over there we have the Scythians, over here, you know, as you say, we have the Kabari, whatever it is. But what we might possibly be looking at is again the same people. And although we have these many different names, in many cases we still can find the connection in the etymology, right?
From the etymology, absolutely, because this is something that couldn't be wholly changed. They've done a beautiful job, don't get me wrong. Vowels have been totally interchanged, consonants have been interchanged, titles have been renamed into names and names into titles, you know, and I go into this in the Irish Origins book. There's a chapter on this called The Sacred Language of the Ancients,
right,
where I talk about the ways that the language is corrupted. You know, for instance, the word Osiris, I've always maintained in my book that Osiris was originally a Western god that was brought to Egypt. He wasn't native to Egypt at all. It's a perfect example of what you're talking about. If you spell the word Osiris, it's O-S-I-R-I-S. But in Egyptian, it's not spelled like that at all. It's spelled as Osares, A-U-S-A-R-E-S. But that again is a corruption. It's not Osares, it's Osari. Osiris is really Osari.
Right.
A-U-S, right? That's one word. A-U-S, separate word, A-R-I. Osari, the god of the Ari.
Right, right.
The man of the earth, the man of the wisdom, the man of the secrets. You see, so, my God, man, we've got Bulgaria. Bull, Bell, like Baltic and Baldur.
Mm-hmm.
Bulgaria is nothing more than Belgaria, Aria.
Right.
Bulgaria, area, there's the word. Sumeria, like I said.
Mm.
Armenia. Iran, like the Aran Islands off the west coast of Ireland. Aran. Right?
Mm.
What are the ancient names of India? In fact, one of the earliest and the most important names of India was Arya Nadu, or Arya Desu, meaning the land of the Arya.
Hmm.
We got Joseph of Arimathea. Also, we had Ralph Ellis talking about the famous Joseph of Arimathea,
who
became the custodian of Jesus of Gamala, remember?
Yeah.
Took him down from the cross, kind of negotiated with the lunatic Vespasian to make sure that he could get custody of these crucified men, you see, who were terribly, castrated and terribly deformed, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The famous Joseph of Arimathea that all the British Israelites do somersaults over, saying he brought Jesus to, Britain. So there we have it.
Yeah.
Well, that whole story, the real story is told in my Irish Origins book is anything but that. But the point being that there we have the Arimathea bit is already saying Joseph of the Ari.
Right, right. Very interesting.
I mean, we've got it. It's all there. It's all there, man, for the trained eye to see.
Very, very interesting. Michael, before we round things up here for our program here today, I do want to talk about a little bit about the upcoming conference. We need to squeeze that in here. As I said, the third and fourth of May, Michael will be attending the Beyond Knowledge Conference that is taking place in Liverpool, England. So if you're interested in hearing Michael Tesarian speak or some of the other researchers there, we have David Hatcher Childress, Marcus Allen, Jerry Smith, Ken Thomas, Ralph Ellis is going to be there. Also Ian Crane and David Griffin. If you're interested in that, you need to pop on over to their website for more information about tickets and times, where it is, etc., etc. The website is beyond-knowledge.co.uk. Again, that's beyond-knowledge.co.uk. So if you're in either in England or around the UK area or in Europe for that matter, and are interested in that, that's definitely something worth checking out. And Michael, tell us a little bit what you're going to be talking about on the conference.
I've been invited to speak on the Irish origins, basically. The book came out last November, and it's been just, great. People have we've been sold out for over a month. Can't keep the books in.
Very good, yeah.
It's just outrageous. So I did agree, to do this conference is a perfect opportunity to do my first talk ever, actually, in the world, apart from our show. We've did four or five shows on the Irish origins of civilization.
Yeah.
Including this one, actually, would make a good
addition to that.
Yeah, exactly, that series. But I've never done a public talk, and I didn't know if I was going to do one, for various reasons and whatnot. I could talk on lots of other things as well, but I'll definitely be doing this talk on the Irish origins of civilization. It will be a slideshow presentation. Been glad to participate in that because it's a tremendous list of speakers there,
Yeah.
Ralph Ellis is, a huge mentor of mine. Love his work. Read
right.
Everything he's written.
Yeah.
David Howitzer Childress is a legend in the field.
Right.
Absolutely. So, Ken Thomas, look at the work he's done,
Yeah.
He's a good friend. And he and Jerry Smith have always been very supportive. In my early days when I started, when I did conferences and appeared in public, they literally were like so supportive and so happy to see me. You know, it was a very welcoming feeling.
Very good.
This goes for so many others as well. But so I think that people who miss this, it's this crazy. They should really get over there. If not to see what I'm doing, but definitely to support and to keep this kind of subject matter alive, to show people that we will turn up for events like this and
yeah.
We have got the interest, because just look at the rubbish that's out there. I mean, it's stupefying when you just think of the utter nonsense.
Yeah.
So when you have a group of teachers and thinkers of this caliber,
it's
in
worth,
one place, people should support it, with everything they've got,
Exactly. So again, if you're interested in catching Michael or some of the other fine researchers, speakers there, go over to the website beyond-knowledge.com. co.uk, and myself and Frederick is going to be there also, not to do any talks or anything, but definitely to meet up with some of the fine researchers and listen to their talks. It's going to be a lot of fun getting over there, and I guess we'll see you there, Michael.
That's true. One other point, Henrik, is that I will not be bringing any merchandise, so if people want to have a signed copy of anything, they need to make their purchases online, just as a side that people need to realize that I won't be bringing any, you know, books or tapes or anything like that. These are all available online, and if they want something signed, you know, they'll have to bring it with them, because I won't be bringing merchandise at, you know, myself.
Okay, very good. You know what, also, before we finish up here, tell us, when do you think that the new book here on astrotheology will be out, and what website do people need to go to get a copy of that when it's out?
It's pretty much written now. It's just, we have other things to do, of course, like layout and all these things, and it does take a bit of time. So, you know, maybe within the next 90 days, we should see the first copies. You know, I mean, I don't push anything because I like things to be as good as they can be.
Right.
So, but ultimately, it's a job nearly finished, so I think it should be this summertime, late spring, summer should be already finished, and people can see lots of previews and excerpts and on the website astro-theology.net or astro-theology.org, either one, they can go to those, or just go to michaeltessarian.com and you'll see the link.
Exactly.
And they can see all the, you know, the previews there.
Very good. The main websites again is michaeltessarian.com, and for the topic that we've been speaking about tonight here, or today here, is astro-theology.net. That's going to get you a lot more information on that one. Michael, thank you very much for coming on the program, and I think we need to do a part two of this one, because we still have a few points to finish up on, right?
Oh, I'd love to do that anytime. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Red Ice Creations Radio. We will be back on Thursday with David Hatcher Childress. We'll be talking about the Crystal Skulls and Easter Island. Fascinating program, not to be missed. My thanks to Fredrik behind the controls. My name is Henrik Palmgren. The website is redicecreations.com. redicecreations.com. See you online, and we'll talk more soon.
As I rode out one fine summer's morn, among lofty hills, moorlands, and mountains, it was there I spied a wheel ford mare. As I way others was suit to hunt, no shoes nor stockings did he wear, and neither had she cap nor feather, but her golden hair hung ringlets its fair, and the gentle breeze blew round her shoulders. I said, for all, lassie, why roam your lane? Why roam your lane among the heather? Said my feathers wafting, and I'm heard in all his yows together. I said, for all, lassie, if you'll be mine, and care to lie on a bed of feather, in silks and satins you will shine, and you'll be my queen among the heather. She said, kind sir, your offer's good, ah, but I'm afraid 'twas meant for laughter, for I see you are some rich squire's son, and I am but a poor shepherd's dog. Had ye been a shepherd, a herd in yows in yonder valley, or had ye been some ploughman's son, we all might my heart I could you now I've been to halls and I've been to balls. I have been to London and the water, but the bonniest lass that e'er I saw, she was hair than yows and